The Titans of Trial podcast is sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.
From the Florida Justice Association, these are the Titans of Trial.
I think a big difference that I made in the early days was I was able to persuade some first-class experts to come forward and testify in malpractice cases.
Stuart Grossman discusses the difficulties in taking on medical malpractice cases and the role instinct plays in winning them.
Trial lawyers need instinct. And when I say need it, I'm not talking about the kind you can be trained to have or buy in a store or take CLEs for. Or even listen to this. You either have it or you don't. And then you have to have the courage to act upon it and do some things that are just not orthodox.
And on finding your own originality.
I think that if you fashion your career based upon somebody else's way of doing it, I'm afraid the career won't come out the way you wanted it to.
Welcome to Titans of Trial, featuring the personal stories of the men and women who've made a difference to the practice of trial law in Florida. I'm Paul Jess, Executive Director of the Florida Justice Association. As a young man growing up in Coral Gables, Stuart Grossman was upset at the social injustices shown on the television news every night and wanted to change that if he could. He could, and he did. His victories include the largest verdict of its time for the death of a child and a more than $1 billion settlement in a bank overdraft class action. His mentors include his first boss, the legendary J.B. Spence. Among Stuart's many honors is the Perry Nichols Award, the FJA's most prestigious award. It's given to an attorney whose perseverance, commitment, an unmatched dedication to the civil justice system is at the forefront of his or her life. Stuart Grossman sat down with Florida Justice Association radio host Harvey Bennett in May of 2019 to discuss the importance of self-reflection, the key advice he has to share with younger attorneys, and the personal medical tragedy that struck his life.
Stuart, you spent your career focusing on personal injury, wrongful death, with a specialty on medical malpractice, and you've won an unprecedented number of favorable verdicts along with some of the largest multi-million dollar awards in Florida. How did you gravitate to medical malpractice?
Well, I had, I think, one of the greatest mentors of all time, whose name was J.B. Spence. And J.B. was Miami's premier trial lawyer. I met him when he came and lectured to my class at the University of Miami. And I showed up a day or two later at his office and asked if he needed a law clerk. And he said, okay, wound up staying through that clerkship and then as an associate and as a name partner, and left 15 years later when Neil Roth and I formed our own firm. But J.B. was a pioneering medical malpractice lawyer back in the day when you couldn't get experts, when there was a conspiracy of silence on the part of hospitals and doctors that you would sue, where they would never point a finger at someone else. Back in the day where the jury charges were so unfavorable towards plaintiffs. And I learned under the most rugged conditions. And I had him as a great mentor.
What did you learn from him? What lessons did you take away from that you've used in your career?
Well, I think the greatest thing about JB was his humanness. And I don't think you can learn humanness, but you can see what an attractive quality that is when you're speaking to six strangers like jurors. As opposed to trying to be a highfalutin, silk stocking, guy using extensive and expensive words. I try to concentrate on the story at hand and put it in language that is not cloudy or obscure. Just be direct and related to their own human experience. That, I think, is what I learned from him.
Mm. How did you go about honing your skills? The old-fashioned way?
Oh, yeah. He would drag me along as second chair, and then he'd give me witnesses, and then eventually I had, of course, my own case load. But it was the old-fashioned way of literally learning at the feet and the hands of the masters. And I had another great mentor in our firm named Dick Massington, who interestingly is now of counsel to my firm. Mm-hmm. So Dick and I have been together over 50 years.
Wow. Well, you were born in Pittsburgh, although you went to University of Miami here, undergrad and law school. What made you want to be a lawyer in the first place?
Well, it was accidental. I was a pretty good student of literature and the humanities in undergraduate school. And a buddy of mine from Gables High's basketball team, also a student at the University of Miami, and he had a book under his arm, something about an LSAT. And I said, George, what's that? And he said, I'm going to take the law school exam. And I was thinking, well, you know, I wouldn't mind being an English teacher or a professor or something. And I said, well, if you're going to take it, I'm going to take it. Can I borrow the book? And I did, and I wound up taking it. I'm the first person in my family that graduated college, so I never had an uncle who was a lawyer, much less a big-time lawyer, and didn't have anybody pushing me in that direction. I was sort of free to explore, and I had the right parents for that, because if I started out pre-med and I made a switch, they let me do that. They let me follow the path that felt best to me, for which I'm eternally grateful.
Oh, yeah. That's important.
Yes.
What were the most important influences in your life growing up, and lessons that you learned that prepared you or guided you in law?
Well, I think that I realized I was having emotional reactions to injustice. So if I were watching the CBS Evening News and someone was being beaten or hosed or bitten by a dog or pushed around or mistreated in some way, I kind of got transfixed on that. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering about the human condition, both from the person that was suffering and as well, who could do this to someone else? I've often wondered about what kind of person that is.
And you're talking specifically about the civil rights era of the 60s?
Civil rights era, yes. The treatment of migrant workers, both in Florida and in California. Unions and how they were getting trampled. I formed, I guess, what I'd call my own internal values that were based on these emotional responses to things that I wanted to change if I could, or deal with.
Now, you've had some remarkable cases that really stand out. One of them was Goldberg versus Florida Power and Light. Tell us about that one.
Oh, it was such a sad case. A little girl is with her mother coming back from shopping where she bought some hair braids, and another mother was taking her child to swimming practice. So we have two housewives with their children in the back seat of their cars. Just before they were to collide in an intersection, a woman observed in her backyard in this neighborhood that a power line had fallen and created a singe on her lawn. It was about 7 feet long and about a quarter of an inch wide. And so she decided, that's electric wire, I got to call FPL, which was appropriate. FPL sent 7 trucks out to her backyard. And after they analyzed the situation, they determined that they had to kill the power in that neighborhood. And that included a traffic signal. And it was a dark and stormy afternoon. And at that time, they sent a lineman up to kill the power. But before he did, the police department in that neighborhood known as Pinecrest stopped and asked FPL twice, "Do you need help with traffic? Do you need help with traffic?" Well, when he threw the switch and killed the power, it was to one of the major busy intersections. And now these two mothers with their kids in the back on a dark, stormy night are entering an intersection where there's no light. Light's dead. And one mother hit the other, hit Mrs. Goldberg, and spun her around. And then another oncoming vehicle struck the car and killed her precious 8-year-old child, Jill. Both Jill was killed and her mother was badly injured. And that case was significant because it was so difficult to ever get a verdict against the power companies in Florida. They are cloaked in immunity for all kinds of activities. And without boring you, just suffice it to say it went up. We won this verdict, which was the largest verdict in American law history at the time for the death of a child. It went up on appeal to our intermediate court. It was affirmed. Then a judge there decided, no, he wanted to have the whole court hear it. And seven judges then ruled.
The entire appellate here.
The whole intermediate appellate court, seven judges. They then ruled against us, 4-3. And with that, we then went to the Florida Supreme Court, and we won there 7-0. And that case, I think, had a lot to do with taking care not just of a family, but our society here in South Florida, because it put us more on an equal footing with this monopolistic power company that has a lot to do with our lives.
Absolutely.
And just to think that they could kill the power. What if someone was on a respirator, which they were in the neighborhood? People are adversely affected. Someone in an elevator, someone in an operating room. I mean, you know, they just can do that. Well, not so fast now. Now you got to take some precautions. Mm-hmm. and not pretend as if you own the whole environment, which was outrageous.
And that was a case that probably affected some positive policy change, at least.
Absolutely.
On their part, possibly regulation.
Well, I think so. And also enlisting the police aid. If you notice now, you drive around, you see patrol cars at a lot of these sites where FPL and tree trimmers and other people are digging. Mm-hmm. I think I've probably made more off-duty hours for police, which is another good thing, so that they get assigned to those work sites. And that certainly makes the situation much safer for everybody.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Well, another huge case that you had was that class action involving bank overdrafts.
Yeah, these are the major banks in America. Had a system worked out that was absolutely perverted. If you had a debit card and say you took money out of the debit card, they wouldn't do it chronologically. They would do it with the largest deduction first, then the second largest, then the third largest, so that you kept getting late fees, late fee after late fee after late fee, when you weren't really late if they took it chronologically.
Right.
And we uncovered that, and I was proud to be among the lead counsel on the plaintiff side, and that was over $1 billion in recovery.
That was huge.
Yeah, it was huge because they were huge thieves. They were stealing those numbers. We got the money back. I mean, that's what made it so big.
And a lot of people don't catch on to some of those practices by corporations either, do they?
I mean,
sometimes it's really just enough under the radar that unless someone's really watching or very detail-oriented, right?
Well, yes, and on top of that, these banks and other large institutions now have you sign arbitration clauses. And the individuals, if they had to go to arbitration and weren't part of a class, never would have been able to sue the bank because the amount it took to hire a lawyer and the costs far stripped out probably what your late fees were. But with a system that allows for class actions, then people who have smaller amounts of damages can pool together and stop an enormous practice like this and correct it. And I'm told that the banks no longer do this, and I believe that.
So another positive change from law.
Yeah, but they'll be back. There's nothing quite like a group of banks.
You have a favorite story that you like to tell, and it has to do with picking a jury, which is such a key element to being a trial lawyer.
Yeah, I think that among the things that I remember, and may I say to those of us that are listening that have had the privilege of trying jury trials, you know the way it goes. Sometimes trials have a lot of stories and a lot of moments in them that are worth capturing. But this one story dealt with my picking a jury. And Andy Yaffa, my partner, was seated at counsel table while I was questioning jurors. And there were three rows of jurors, and I'm now in the back row asking questions. And I came upon the next juror, who happened to be a domestic worker, African-American, in her 60s. And I asked her her name, and she told me. And then I said, "What do you do for a living?" And she identified her domestic job. And I thanked her very much. And I went on to the next juror, and the next juror, and asking them much more extensive questions about their backgrounds. And when I came to sit down, Andy pulled me aside. I said, "You didn't ask that lady in the back, the domestic worker, anything." And I looked at him, I said, "I don't need to." And the reason why I didn't need to was because all of my instincts told me she would be super. She made it, and I made it onto the jury, and it was a remarkable case also. The moral of that story is twofold. I think, number one, trial lawyers need instinct. And when I say need it, I'm not talking about the kind you can be trained to have or buy in a store or take CLEs for, or even listen to this. You either have it or you don't. And then you have to have the courage to act upon it and do some things that are just not orthodox, like there are more questions, because then the other side could come up with the fact that, well, she's an appealing lady to the plaintiff, and give them a reason to possibly challenge her for cause if she said too much, but at a minimum, put her on their hit list when it came time to complete their jury selection.
You're playing poker in a way.
Yes, that's a very good analogy.
You know, it's very interesting because your partner, who we have sat down with in this Titan of Trial series, Neil Roth, made a similar comment on instinct. Richard Slauson in West Palm Beach, the same thing, even to the point where taking a case that others would think, that's a loser, why are you taking that? Instinct. And it seems an interesting concept in a field where you have set laws, very set procedures. It seems kind of anti-intuitive in a way.
Yeah, it does. I just finished my fourth quadriplegia case involving, they all involve tourists who come to South Florida, sometimes the Keys, sometimes the Miami area, whatnot, and they dive into shallow water. And for those of us that live here, we know the water's shallow. For those of us that don't, they don't know. And while it defies our logic that you would actually take these cases and take on major corporations like Ritz-Carlton or this hotel chain or that hotel, Waldorf Astoria is another one, for the conduct of the plaintiff himself, who puts his injuries in motion. He's the person that's doing it. There's no vehicle that's going to strike him. Many people would shy away from those, and we've thrived. But even Neil has told me, "How can you win this one?" And somehow we do.
You've written a lot on the subject of medical malpractice, so much so that medical associations and societies have you come and speak to their members. That's got to be very satisfying just in and of itself.
It is satisfying because the tone and the theme that I use is one of helpfulness to try to get them to avoid malpractice, as opposed to coming and telling them war stories and snickering about, "Oh, I caught you doing this or that." Earlier in my career, I did a lot of maternal fetal medicine and brain damaged babies, the result of improper monitoring or improper maternal care, things of that nature. And those cases were heartbreaking because the children would have cerebral palsy or similar lives to live. As I used to say, they're the kid in the wheelchair when you walk in the movie theater that's in the aisle. And they're always being pointed out, or someone's always thinking, how did that happen? At least I was always thinking that. Mm-hmm. And when I look back at some of the fact patterns of cases I've had, it so angers me that this was preventable. And so I've hoped I could convey to health caregivers, do better. Think. Utilize the monitoring at hand and learn what the monitor means. Don't just do it for the sake of doing it. Understand what the information is that you're getting. And I hope in my own small way that what I've written and what I've lectured about has helped.
And you have a personal connection, too, to medicine. Some of your most significant cases, some of your proudest moments of what you've been able to accomplish.
Yeah. Back in the day when I was with JB, those were the early days of medical malpractice. He and Bill Colson, another legendary attorney, won the first $1 million case in medical malpractice in the country. And back then, you were fighting to obtain expert witnesses. It was damn near impossible. There was something called the conspiracy of silence that existed between doctors and hospitals, and when they would get sued, no one would ever point a finger and say that person did wrong or otherwise. It was tough sledding then. It was like building a city out of nothing, just with rocks in your bare hands, and I did that. It's made so much easier now by having expert access and whatnot. I think a big difference that I made in the early days was I was able to persuade some first-class experts to come forward and testify in malpractice cases. That was a luxury JB and Bill never had, but I brought that in, I think, and Spence used to not believe, how'd you get this guy to testify? I said, well, start reading on the topic, and you pick up the phone and call them at Harvard or Yale, and if they're interested, they'd come forward and help.
What would you say is your key to success? Is there any one skill?
You've asked a question now that I've been asked before, and the answer is, I think there's one that looms larger than others, and that is that I think I look at facts a little bit differently than my fellow trialers. And I think that makes all the difference in the world. Maybe just a degree or two, but I imagine things or think through things in my own strategic way that, to me, have made all the difference in the world. I haven't been somebody who's spent a lot of time reading how others do it. I've spent a lot of time looking into myself and figuring out how I'm going to do it.
You have that freedom to explore.
And explore I do.
Do you still get nervous before you go to a trial?
Oh, sure. But the things that make me nervous now aren't what I'm going to be able to do. I'm never nervous about that. My witnesses are prepared. My exhibits are prepared. I know all that. What makes me nervous is, of course, how's the judge going to behave when the rubber meets the road and he's got to make some rulings? How is the defense going to behave? Are they going to take the gloves off and make me the object of the trial, or are they going to stick to the facts? And no matter what it is, you have to be prepared and be flexible to move into the currents, whichever direction they take you. But that, if you were going to ask me about nerves, is just in that particular area of the unexpected, that which I don't control. And I think it's probably healthy to be nervous about it, and certainly not paralyzingly nervous, nor dependent on alcohol to get over your nerves. I mean, it is a very practical matter. But just, you know, stay on your toes. You got to be able to see around corners and hear little sounds and everything else.
And despite your hard work and best efforts, sometimes things don't go your way. How do you handle disappointment?
I work through it. And I have my whole career. I just show up and go after it again.
How important is self-reflection in what you do?
Well, to me, it's everything. Because I think that if you fashion your career based upon somebody else's way of doing it, I'm afraid the career won't come out the way you wanted it to. You know, they say about the NFL, it's a copycat league, meaning one team studies how the other does it. And I think that works in the NFL. I think in a courtroom, being yourself, your own originality, your own comfort level, is the key to success. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's all about self-introspection and analysis, knowing what you can do well, what you can't do well, never imitating, stuff like that.
Yeah, and again, giving yourself permission to have that freedom to try something, see what works.
I think that's a very good way of putting it.
What are you most proud of?
On a professional basis, that we have changed lives. In my field, we're the people that come in after the disaster has struck. And we know that we can do just so much. But we also know that that just so much that we can do is so extraordinarily amplified because of the overwhelming needs of our client, that to be able to help them through an impossible situation, be it emotional, financial, is the most gratifying, to change lives. On a personal basis, when I lost my beloved daughter, Margot, at age 15, we set about to create a foundation to try to unravel the cancer that killed her, which is called Ewing's sarcoma, E-W-I-N-G-S. And we discovered that there's no money in finding a cure for pediatric cancers generally. They're called orphan cancers. And the reason why there's no money is because pharmaceutical companies have to develop protocols and drugs costing billions of dollars, and if you have just a small patient sampling, how are they going to get the money back? So we set about through Sloan Kettering to raise funds, and other families have contributed and whatnot. And this past March at our annual luncheon, we had reported to us that we're 96% cure rate now.
That's true.
From recurrence of Ewing sarcoma.
That's terrific.
And I think something big is going to happen this year, but I can't reveal it because of SEC considerations. And the person that gave me the information said, please don't quote me, and so I can't.
Sure, sure. And you have been a big supporter of medical charities. I suppose part of that is your personal story with your daughter. Part of that, the result of your trial work and what you've seen.
Yeah, I was chairman for a while of United Cerebral Palsy here in Miami-Dade County. And we had telethon and things of that nature. But I'd like to think I would have done that even if I wasn't in the field I'm in.
Let's talk about the Florida Justice Association. You are a past winner of the Perry Nichols Award, one of the top honors of the association. You're a distinguished fellow. You are head of the senior members of the FJA, have won the Compassionate Gladiator Award. You're an Eagle Award winner, inducted into the Hall of Fame. Stuart, how has your involvement with the Florida Justice Association impacted your career?
Well, I've gotten more from the FJA than it's gotten from me. So if you added up all the hundreds of thousands of dollars, what it's done for me and my colleagues has been greater. Because, first of all, it's given us a unified and powerful voice to hang on to, if not implement, good legislation and defeat sometimes horrific legislation that comes from evil imaginations of some of our state legislatures. I just cannot imagine how they dream up these things.
There is an effort at several points, including just this last session, but I'm thinking of the constitutional amendment a year ago that would have put a cap on non-economic damages.
Caps on damages. Who would do this? If you're not going to cap someone's suffering, why would you cap the compensation they get for suffering? I just don't understand it. If you wrecked their car, would you expect to pay 20% of its value? Should we cap that at $2,000 and you destroy a $25,000 automobile? I mean, what's this about? The whole concept of caps is a outlandish nightmare that's visited or is attempted to be visited on our citizenry by what I again consider to be evil legislators.
Is it important to give back to the FJA as you have done, especially the foundation, which focuses on the education, the ongoing education and the research?
I don't even feel like I'm giving back. If I do a limited number, and the FJA knows this, I like to do the big stuff for them, maybe once, rarely more than one time a year. But I've made so many great friends. The FJA has been so meaningful to my development as a lawyer that I don't feel I've sacrificed at all, to tell you the truth. I've just gotten back so much more. And by the way, Spence, JB, took me to Tallahassee the first few months I started practicing and said, this is where you got to win. It's not enough to win in court. You got to win in the legislature and win in political races. And we've been true to that. We haven't always won, God knows, particularly the governor's races in the state. But at least they know we're coming.
What's your view on the future of the legal profession? Do you have concerns?
Yeah, I just had lunch today with one of our United States Circuit Court of Appeals judges. And he told me, first he asked me to guess what percentage of cases nationally go to trial in the federal system. And I thought, well, 10%. He said, Stuart, it's less than 2%, and in many places, 1% and less. He said, the jury trial is dying on the vine. And I said to him, and when you add to that arbitration clauses that creep into the way we do business, all kinds of contracts, I suspect pretty soon you'll have an arbitration clause on your can of Coca-Cola. You know, you drink this, you're bound by our arbitration clause. It's very alarming. It's very alarming to me. I don't feel good about the way I see rights being wholesaled away from our citizens. I wish I could tell you that we'll have jury trials 100 years from now, but I'll do my part and try cases until the end.
Do you think that's in part why some people criticize the legal system as having become or is becoming commoditized?
Well, I think that that's a valid criticism. When you don't hold jury trials sacred, and when you discount people's injuries financially, not the pain they're feeling, mind you, just the recovery. When you let arbitration clauses do the talking and not a jury verdict speak, then you're in deep trouble. And so, yes, it has become commoditized, and hopefully we're fighting even hand-to-hand combat. with those forces.
What one piece of advice would you have for an incoming lawyer at this point?
Well, I think that I would give the same advice now that I probably followed in my own career. Number one, follow your passion. Number two, be yourself. And then number three, if you can position yourself with honorable, clear-thinking colleagues in a firm where you can have a free flow of ideas and people will help with management issues and do other things that you may not be strong at, I think that those three elements would be very important.
And that's worked with your law practice here, hasn't
it? It's been my blessed professional career.
This is a very tough profession on human beings. I mean, it's a very complex, a lot of hours, a lot of challenges, a lot of demands. How have you balanced your professional life with your family life?
Well, I have to tell you that I have a saying that there's nothing I haven't missed. By that, I mean weddings, bar mitzvahs, funerals, football games. I missed it all because I had to be somewhere. And for me, strangely enough, the balance was in making those that love me understand that I have this calling that's jealous and has to be met. And then I try to make it up to them, throughout the year. So I'm fortunate enough to go on to Montecito out in California for the summer and work from my house out there and do things like that. But even before, I, you know, always had a boat, always did the keys, always did this, always did that, and always took along a kid and a dog, and sometimes two kids and sometimes three dogs, and made the most out of that, and went to probably 1,000 Heat games and God knows how many football games over the years, but it was always a balance. But the understanding had to be that while I was eager to balance, I didn't hold the weights. The force of the practice held the weight, and then I'd try to balance it off later on. Mm-hmm. And I would urge those listening to, just like I talked about finding honorable partners, to try to find a life companion that understands the demands that are going to be made upon you. And you don't really have much of a choice except to ignore those demands. And then when you start to do that, the end is near. You've pretty much subscribed to a defeated career.
Stuart, how would you like to be remembered?
He loved his work, and he gave it his all. And he was fortunate to be in a position to help some folks, and he did. And I can't believe how fortunate I've been, really. So, and honestly, whatever your memory is of me, even after today, or someone else's, I can live with that. I know I didn't try to mold you or bend you into thinking one way or another. I answered you the truth.
Stuart Grossman, you are a titan of trial. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
This is Paul Jess. We hope you enjoyed listening to this Titans of Trial episode. If you're not already a member, we'd like to invite you to join the Florida Justice Association. Please visit us on the web at floridajusticeassociation.org or drop us a line at radio@floridajusticeassociation.org.
Thank you for listening to this Titans of Trial podcast, sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.